Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Over 100 right-wing activists who had barricaded themselves in a Gaza Strip hotel were forcibly removed by Israeli soldiers today. Later, Israel's Defense Force declared the Gaza Strip a closed military zone, banning entry to all Israelis who do not live in Gaza as settlers. Both moves come after days of increasingly tense and violent demonstrations, primarily by radical West Bank settlers who've been traveling to Gaza to protest the planned evacuation of all Gaza settlements and four West Bank settlements 7 weeks from now. Well, joining us is Greg Myrie. He's a Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. And Greg, it sounds like a tense 24 hours. Has there been a marked shift? And what happened at the Gaza hotel? Greg, are you there?
Yes, I am.
No problem. What happened at the Gaza hotel?
Well, the Israeli security forces stormed the building today, and they removed about 150 or so radical right-wing Jewish protesters who'd been holed up there for a month or so. They had moved to the Gaza Strip to fight against the planned withdrawal of the Jewish settlers in Gaza set for later this summer.
Yeah, there was also a violent incident yesterday at a Gaza settlement called Gush Katif. I gather settlers there are more moderate, normally have good relations with local Arab residents. Explain what went on there.
Right. This was literally just a few hundred yards down the beach from the hotel that was raided today. And some of the same group, some of these activists that have come in from outside the Gaza Strip, had taken over a couple abandoned Palestinian homes. And there had been sort of daily stone throwing between these Jewish activists and the Palestinians. And it was becoming more and more intense, and several people were, in fact, hurt yesterday on both sides. And the Israeli security forces then moved in and made about 40 arrests yesterday. And then that also, I think, contributed to the decision to clean out the hotel today. The Israeli authorities decided that they can't allow this influx of protesters and demonstrators, that it's just going to greatly complicate their efforts to remove the settlers in Gaza.
Well, we understand the Gush Katif settlers have also been unhappy, at least some of them, about others traveling from the West Bank, the radicals traveling in from the West Bank.
Yes, I mean, I make the distinction that the Gush Katif settlers are very much, these are the settlers in Gaza, very much opposed to being evacuated, as Prime Minister Ariel Sharon wants to do. And they say that they certainly welcome support. People who want to back them are welcome to come and join their cause. However, they have made it clear they don't want to be involved in illegal or violent demonstrations. So there has been a split developing between the Gaza settlers and some of these outsiders. Some of them are West Bank settlers who are coming there but taking on more radical actions and more confrontational steps. And the Gaza settlers say, no, we do want to protest, but we want to do it in a legal, peaceful manner.
I'm wondering if this is one of the reasons the government today decided to declare the Gaza Strip a closed military zone to seal
it. Yes, very much. What this means is that people cannot, Israelis, can no longer go in and out of the Gaza settlements as they've been able to do freely until the middle of the day today. It was no difficulty, no problem for any Israeli to drive in, visit, or stay inside the Gaza settlements. Now Israel says, at least for the time being, only those Gaza settlers will be allowed to stay inside the settlements. No outside visitors will be allowed in. Again, this is to prevent the outsiders from coming in and stirring up demonstrations.
Well, Greg, this violence was predicted in the run-up to the August closure of the settlements. I'm wondering, first of all, the settlement closure was pushed back once. Any chance it will be pushed back again? And how are Israelis reacting to this?
Ariel Sharon says no, it won't be pushed back. It was delayed for 3 weeks from July until now mid-August is the scheduled starting date of the evacuation. But the government is saying no, it won't be pushed back at this point, and that's the latest we have to go on. Now, Israelis are very divided on this. I mean, there is certainly a lot of Israelis who do support the Gaza settlers and the settlements in general and want to see Israel hold on to them. There are those, and seem to be in the majority, according to polls over the past year and a half, that want Israel to leave Gaza. That think that Gaza is a net liability. that it costs a lot of money, that it's very dangerous, and Israel should pull out and leave that to the Palestinians. So there is a split, but certainly the polls over the last year have shown that a majority of Israelis do want the Gaza pullout to go ahead.
We understand Israelis are wearing orange or blue, declaring themselves to be with the settlers or against them. Greg Myrie, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times, thanks for checking in with us.
Thank you.
During the high-profile visit of the Vietnamese Prime Minister to the U.S. last week, a little-known agreement was signed that could change the lives of hundreds of Americans hoping to become parents. That agreement will allow Americans to once again adopt children from Vietnam. 2 years ago, that country put a hold on overseas adoptions after Vietnamese police claimed they uncovered criminal rings selling children to foreigners. Well, this comes as several countries, including Russia, Ukraine, and Romania, have changed their laws to make it more difficult and, in some cases, impossible for Americans to adopt children. Well, joining us for a check-in on foreign adoptions is Marina Mayhew, President and Executive Director of Commonwealth Adoptions International in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Debbie Shaw of Houston, Texas. She's in the process of adopting a little girl from Russia. Debbie, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Marina, let's start with you. We should say you are a Russian. You've adopted a child from Russia. Let's focus on Russia. Why has it become so difficult for children to be adopted from that country?
Well, I would say, Robin, that Russian government is not currently happy with the existing adoption system. They have concerns about the declining of domestic adoption. They have concerns about financial transparency of the process. They also have great concerns about children trafficking and well-being of the children after the adoption takes place.
We understand this has become a battle in Russia, pitting some government liberals and child care agencies against nationalist politicians who are alleging the things that you've said.
Absolutely. That's a very, very controversial subject right now in Russia, and there are lots of debates going on about that.
We're reading that under Russian law, adoption is supposed to be free, but these adoptions cost, you know, upwards of $20,000. So some Russians are worried that agencies will be more interested in making money and sending children to foreigners than helping Russians adopt children.
Well, all the adoption agencies working in Russia, I would say, are nonprofit organizations, and they run in accordance with the financial standards in this country. So they have to charge, they are charging families to adopt from Russia. And you're right, adoptions in Russia are free. However, agencies operating in Russia provide extensive humanitarian aid projects for the children who are not being adopted.
Well, Russia is the number two source for overseas adoptions for Americans, second only to China. Debbie, why did you decide to adopt a child from Russia?
I decided to go to Russia because I had only a few countries that were available to me due to my age and due to being a single parent. I turned 50 last August, right before I started my process. And I was trying to decide between Russia and another country. And with those being equal, I decided that it might be, I had an idea in my mind that it might be best for my child if I adopted a more Caucasian-looking child so that she would look more like me in appearance-wise.
Yeah, and how is your adoption going?
Overall, it's going fine, but there certainly have been some frustrations with the changes in the laws. When I very first started this process and joined with Commonwealth, I was under the expectation that it would take probably about a year. Since some of the changes started happening, the waits have gotten a little longer, and it makes you feel like you just don't know when another change might happen. It's the unknown, and knowing that there are some issues that are trying to be addressed, you just don't know when something else is going to happen, and so that puts an air of uncertainty. About the time that I was going to go to Russia to meet the child, the laws changed. I think actually 2 days before my trip was scheduled.
How did they change that affected you?
The law that changed in January was a change in database laws where children are in the database before they're eligible for international adoption. so that the families in Russia have first choice to be able to adopt the children.
Wait, this is in response to the politicians who, as we said, are alleging that children are being trafficked abroad, literally being sold. But Marina, there's another concern in Russia, we understand, a huge outcry because of the highly publicized case of a Chicago woman who was convicted of manslaughter in the death of her 6-year-old adopted Russian son, Alex. I understand that Russians feel that as many as 13 Russian children may have been killed by Americans.
That's correct. What happened with Pavly's case is very, very sad indeed. And the rest of 10 children were murdered in the United States in the course of over 10 years. And comparatively speaking, 12 children were murdered out of 60,000 children who were adopted by American families. And while it is very sad, it's a very rare occasion, very rare.
Yet it's understandable. I mean, if Americans had heard that, 12 children were sent to another country and killed, there would be understandable concern.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And this is one of the reasons why Russian government is trying to make the law more tight, and they are setting higher criteria for American families to adopt the children. It is fairly common for international adoption to see one country going into the turbulent process, and then it eventually smooths out. And some countries, from time to time, they undergo changes, and the process becoming more difficult, or sometimes it's even easier. So, today's Russia, and hopefully soon Russia will become a smooth program, and other countries may have difficulties.
Well, but it seems as if other countries are, Ukraine, Romania. Why do you think there's a trend happening now?
There is certainly concerns about children trafficking, concerns about exploitation, and also there is a political pressure and rising nationalism that really prompting the growing hostility towards international adoptions in many countries. The very little international law governing adoption exists across the borders. Most of what exists is designed primarily to protect against potential abuses in international adoption, but rather than to establish a standard to facilitate such adoptions between countries. So I do believe there is a need of the entity to create a common language between countries in international adoption.
But Deb, I'm wondering, would that be? Are you worried that that might be another layer of bureaucracy, or?
I worry inherently because I think that anyone would feel like that until you're able to have your child at home. But I also am just sticking to the steadfast in my desire that I want a child. I'm just having as much faith as I can. It still does look like, in my case, that I will be able to adopt the baby that I've met. I'm believing that it's going to work out that way.
That's Debbie Shaw of Houston, Texas. She's in the process of adopting a Russian child. And by the way, how old is the little girl?
She was 7 months when I met her. So she'll be 1 year on October the 3rd.
Oh, you must just yearn for her.
I'm ready to have her. I'm ready to have her. Mm-hmm. I am now just waiting for my court date to be set. So hopefully that's in the near future.
Yeah. And Marina Mayhew is President and Executive Director of Commonwealth Adoptions International in Tucson, Arizona. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
And Deb, thanks to you and good luck to you.
Thank you.
And just ahead, we're going to continue our conversation about overseas adoptions. And we'll hear from one teen who was adopted from Bulgaria and reflects some of those fears of foreign adoption. She had them when she met the American couple who wanted to take her away from her orphanage. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're checking in on foreign adoptions. Several countries have recently made them more difficult because of a mix of rumors and facts. Well, 4 years ago, Stephen and Nancy Ortega of Cambridge, Massachusetts, joined the thousands of parents seeking overseas adoptions. They traveled to Bulgaria and adopted two girls. After several tearful years, the adoption of the oldest girl did not work out. The other did, and it gives us a window into how foreigners might view American adoptions. Joining us now, Stephen Ortega. Hello.
Hi.
And one of those girls, 17-year-old Annie. Hi, Annie.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Well, first of all, Annie, I want to start with you. When Stephen and Nancy first showed up in Bulgaria, how old were you?
I was 12.
Did you know about your status? Did you know what they were there for?
I actually didn't know that anybody was coming. The lawyer held me by the hand, and she actually told me that they were going to be my parents.
Yeah.
I was really, really shocked. I was so scared. because that night they expected him to live with them for like 5 days.
To test it out?
Yeah, just to see how it went.
Well, and what kind of thoughts did you bring to this notion of being adopted by someone from another country? Did you have any preconceived thoughts about it? Anything you'd heard? Or?
The kids that we have been living with, they'll just scare us and just basically say that our organs are going to be taken off and everything is going to be destroyed when you get there.
So. Wait, they told you that your organs would be stolen when you got if you got adopted to another country?
Yeah, that the Americans would just take your organs off and...
Well, Steve, did you... I mean, there's a language barrier. Did you have any clue that Annie had those fears?
This isn't something we really discussed until she did really learn to speak English, until she was in the United States. I think that part of the reason it was done was because some of the older kids were jealous.
Boy, Anna, did you have any other fears? I mean, that's a big one, but did you have any other fears about what a foreign adoption might mean?
Yeah, I was kind of fearful, like, coming here and, like, not knowing anybody, just being with them. I was just scared being around them because I didn't know what they would do around me or anything.
Yeah. Hey, what did you think of Americans in general, other than you thought they might steal your organs?
I didn't really think about it anyway because I didn't really know about America. I didn't even know if it existed because the only place I knew was Bulgaria.
Annie, do you feel a need to tell kids here about your past? Do you, as you look at them, do you think that they would understand it, you know, or...
No, I have been telling a lot of my friends about my story, and one of the things is they really don't know where Bulgaria is, and they don't seem to care what has happened to me or anything. I don't think they just understand anything because from what I'm going, I went through a hard time. When I tell them about it, they'll ask me the first thing they'll ask me, is it like the Annie the movie? And I would say, no, it's like worse than that. And I mean, they would beat you up for like food and beat you until you go to sleep and worse things, like make you clean the floors. And
Steve, is there anything you can share with us?
The orphanage she lived in was one of the worst orphanages in the country. I mean, it was a place with lots of broken windows. It was a place that lacked heat in the wintertime. It was a place where the staff was being paid a very low wage. I guess the only way to describe it was a very, very unpleasant place.
Well, so Annie, you begin talking with your dad and mom. Did you begin to understand that they were going to protect you, that you were safe?
I wasn't thinking of that yet. I was at the time scared because we were starting school right away. Just learning the language with them, it was difficult. And the first day I was like, I almost broke my mom's wrist by holding her hand.
So tight.
And saying that she shouldn't let me go. And she kind of felt bad and stuff. But that from then I realized that she really cared about me and stuff.
How do you feel now, Annie? How do you
feel
now?
I feel very, very secure. I feel like they care about me. I don't feel scared as I used to be before.
Steve, a beautiful young lady that you have here as a daughter. How would you characterize these last 4 years of bringing her into this, to her new world, America?
I think it's the best thing we ever did. She's a remarkable person. I mean, a truly remarkable person. Older adoptions are unusual. And from some of the other adoption stories that we've heard, older children who come over here don't usually fare as well. And I think it's just in her genes and in her psychological makeup and in her determination. I mean, she's thrived.
Yeah.
She's become a wonderful soccer player. She does well in school. And I guess in retrospect, that's against all odds.
We mentioned you had there were two adoptions. One didn't fare as well. Now, I know you want to be you're protecting a now teenager, and you want to be sensitive to her, but it did not work out.
No. We're very sorry it didn't work. It was a very tough go, linguistically, culturally, psychologically for her.
And again, you're respecting her desire to be separate from you now.
Yes.
Annie, even legitimate agencies make use of the internet, and I know you had some thoughts about that.
Well, the first time when my dad told me that they found a picture of me on the internet, I felt really weird about it, just thinking about it, that I was sold to them and stuff.
That you were sold to them?
Yes.
You felt that way?
Because, I mean, obviously we heard that they have to give money towards our adoption, and a lot of the money goes to the electricity and everything else in the orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just felt like I was sold to them, that I was nothing.
How do you feel hearing that, Steve?
There are aspects of a particular situation that you don't like. But, you know, we sit here today, you know, Anna is making it through high school. You know, we have an intact family. And I guess I'm willing to forget it, even though I don't like the, I didn't necessarily agree with the means of delivery.
Right. But it was the only way.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel about this whole journey you've been on and this idea of Americans adopting children from other cultures to come to America?
Well, I think it's great. I think that any person, any kind of person that's adopting a little kid or an older kid, I think it's a good opportunity because it lets that person have a child and lets them teach these kids and just have an opportunity to live in a family, not in an orphanage. Because there's so many kids struggling there trying to be adopted, and they don't even know if they have a future life because they don't even know if they're going to die the next day or anything.
I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steven Ortega and his 17-year-old daughter Annie. Steve and his wife adopted Annie from Bulgaria. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and a look now at some breaking news. Time magazine hopes one of its journalists will avoid jail time after the magazine agreed this morning to turn over a reporter's documents in that ongoing investigation of who in the Bush administration leaked the name of an undercover CIA agent's name to the media. The magazine's move comes just days after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the appeals of Time magazine journalist Matt Cooper and New York Times reporter Judith Miller. A federal judge this week gave both journalists 1 week to name their sources or go to jail. Well, joining us on the line from Washington, Richard Schmidt, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
We're also joined by Professor Jeffrey Stone. He's law professor at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Professor.
Delighted to be here.
And Richard, first of all, tell us, what was in the notes? Was the source that Matt Cooper had in the notes? What's the importance of this move today?
Well, that's one of the great unknowns at this point. Time has indicated in its statement today that the documents that it's turning over will obviate the need for Cooper to go to jail. Cooper faces going to jail because he's refusing to identify his sources. Ergo, we're all thinking that the documents that they're going to turn over will indicate who his source was. But we don't know precisely the nature of those documents. There's been some speculation that they may not necessarily include his notes per se, but may include other internal company documents, perhaps email and the like, that reflect who his sources were.
Right. Now, the New York Times, where Judith Miller writes, but did not, by the way, ever write about this story, the New York Times says it's deeply disappointed by the decision of Time magazine.
It's kind of an interesting clash of media titans this morning. I guess we should note that Time, Inc. was itself held in contempt in the case, and the New York Times as a corporate entity was not. I think that's because Time had acknowledged that there were actual documents relating to the sources, while I think there is some question whether or not there were actual documents reflective of sources that the New York Times had. So you have this situation where the Times was not sort of in a situation of contempt like Time magazine was, and so it was in a somewhat different position.
Well, Professor, let's remind ourselves of some history in this case, and Rick, you can jump in on this as well, but the Justice Department launched an investigation after the CIA agent Valerie Plame was named in a column by conservative columnist Robert Novak in July of 2003. And again, a reminder, this was just days after Plame's husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, had in the New York Times criticized the Bush administration's pre-war claims about Iraq and material that was in or was not in Africa. It was thought this was perhaps payback by the Bush administration for Wilson's op-ed piece. So, Professor, since Robert Novak was the person who first wrote about Valerie Plame and first wrote her name, why isn't he the one being threatened with jail?
Well, because grand jury proceedings are secret, we do not know what, in fact, has happened with Robert Novak and the grand jury. One obvious possibility is that Novak was subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury or met with prosecutors and, in fact, revealed to them who disclosed this information to them and did not assert an alleged First Amendment privilege. And in that situation, Novak would have cooperated with the authorities, and the investigation would still continue, because in a situation like this, if there was a crime committed, the prosecutor still needs to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, and corroborating evidence that White House officials revealed this information not only to Novak, but to several other reporters, could be critical to the prosecution. So that's the simplest explanation. And, of course, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's certainly the most logical one.
And Robert Novak isn't speaking, and even former New York Times columnist William Safire is urging him to explain what's going on. He says he'll do that after the investigation is over. But Rick Schmidt, as a journalist, I mean, there's, you know, journalists are buzzing about this. What if he did reveal his source in that investigation?
Well, right. Yeah. I think, you know, the fact of the matter is, in grand jury situations, journalists have always been in a difficult spot when it comes to trying to protect their sources. The Supreme Court's decision earlier this week not to hear this case, you know, I think is basically a reaffirmation of a 1972 case where the court held around the time of Watergate that journalists had no special privilege above and beyond that of ordinary citizens to withhold testimony from grand juries. And so I think, you know, it's always been a difficult spot for journalists, you know, when they're subpoenaed to testify before grand juries. And oftentimes journalists and their lawyers, recognizing that, will try to cut some kind of a deal that will somehow avoid avoid the situation that Judy and Matt have found themselves in.
Well, I want to ask the professor about that because, you know, as we said, Matt Cooper wrote about this story after Robert Novak was the first to reveal the name. Judith Miller investigated this story, never even wrote about Valerie Plame. Her lawyers yesterday said it's a big step to put two people in jail who have committed no crime. And in the case of Judith Miller in particular, she never even wrote about this. Professor, your comments.
No one is being punished here for writing or not writing about the matter. That's not a crime. If they had written about it, it would have changed absolutely nothing. What they're being held in contempt for is refusing to answer questions from the grand jury, which is trying to determine whether a crime was committed, and if so, who committed it. Whether Miller or Cooper wrote stories or didn't write stories is completely irrelevant to the situation they're in right now.
Right. So we have a situation, just to be clear, because we hear from a lot of listeners about this, we have a situation where a reporter, Judith Miller in this case, had a source who gave her information which she did not write, and because she refuses to name the source, she's on her way to jail. Robert Novak had a source, revealed the name of a CIA agent, and because of something he did in a hearing, is not on his way to jail.
Correct, because presumably, again, I don't know this is true, but presumably Novak complied with the demand that he disclose the information. That's the only legal issue that's involved with Cooper and Miller. No one's claiming they did anything unlawful, except for the fact that they refused to disclose the information to the grand jury.
Right. Professor Schmidt, I've combined you two. Professor Stone, what is your sense? Do you think the Times move will keep Matt Cooper from going to jail?
Well, it's hard to know that without knowing how complete the notes are and whether it provides satisfactory evidence for what the prosecutors are looking for. If they are relatively extensive and complete notes, then they probably would be sufficient, at least for this point in the proceeding. At some point, the notes would not be admissible in a criminal trial, and so if an indictment were to issue and there was a trial, the question would again occur about Cooper having to testify, because he would not be allowed to use the reporter's notes, or at least probably would not be allowed to use them, given the fact that the reporter himself would be available.
And in the few seconds we have, Professor, I just have to ask you, what do you think will avoid this? I mean, people are talking about a shield for reporters.
Well, there should be a federal statute that recognizes a shield for reporters, and in my view, it should be a very broad one. But even under the broadest circumstances, in my judgment, it should not cover a case like this one, because the ordinary context in which we're talking about a reporter shield is one in which an individual discloses information to a reporter that is of value to the public, where the information being disclosed.
I got to stop you there, Professor. We'll take this up again. Professor Jeffrey Stone, a law professor at the University of Chicago, and Rick Schmidt from the Los Angeles Times. We'll keep following this. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Take care.
Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, turning to sports, despite what Lance Armstrong dismissed as a silly crash last week, a crash which sent him over the handlebars of his bike and cracked his helmet, Armstrong has pronounced himself fit for the Tour de France, which begins this Saturday. He says it's his last tour, and if he wins, it will be his seventh consecutive conquest of the world's most famous bike race. In the book 23 Days in July, John Wilkinson chronicles Armstrong's 2004 win. He spoke with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR sports program Only a Game, and described how he was able to get access to Lance Armstrong and other riders during last year's race.
Well, we've been close for many, many years. I first met Lance way before he was even a cyclist, when he was like 16. But other cyclists also, most of them, you know, they're very happy to talk to journalists if you respect them and if you respect their time and all the rest of it. And a lot of them are very, very open with you. And I found that in the time that I've been following cycling.
Late in last year's race, Lance Armstrong said that he was enjoying the competition more than he ever had, having more fun racing than he'd ever had before. Given that attitude, are you surprised that he's apparently going to carry out with his decision to retire?
Well, if he does win this year, he will be the oldest winner of the Tour de France in 50 years. So that's one of the reasons it's time for him to quit cycling. Another is his children are starting to grow up. He wants to see them go to school and to help them and to be with them. And he can't do that if he's a professional cyclist in Europe. So that they're both big reasons. Also, he has so much going on in his life besides cycling that taking the cycling part out of it will just make life a little more comfortable for him.
Do fans of cycling worry at all that Lance Armstrong's retirement will leave a void at the top of the sport?
No. Well, if you ask different people, you get different answers. In Europe, most of the people there would be very happy that he's leaving the scene because, you know, 7 years in a row, it could be this year. Whereas the French, they haven't won the Tour de France since 1985, 20 years ago. So they'd be very, very happy to see this void, and they hope that a Frenchman fills it.
Well, talk to me about some of the riders who may be ready to prevent him from winning seven in a row.
There's a whole bunch of riders who could beat Lance. The top of the list, in my opinion, is the young Italian Ivan Basso, who is 27. Last year he finished third in the race. And he would have finished second if he hadn't had a couple of weak time trials. And Jan Ulrich, who was the winner in 1997 before Lance came back from cancer, and he's finished second five times, so he's really itching to win the race. And his teammate from Kazakhstan, Alex Vinokourov, is a very tough competitor. He's a couple of years younger than Lance, and he beat Lance earlier this month in a race called the Dauphiné Libéré, which is in the French Alps. He won a stage at the top of Mont Ventoux, which is a huge mountain in northern Provence. He's going to be up there. So those three riders in particular, and there's some other Spanish riders, there's three Australians who could do well. So once you get below those top three or four, there's probably another dozen who have ambitions of getting on the podium at least.
Now, a couple of months ago, Lance Armstrong told you that the sixth win was the big one because, of course, until last summer, nobody had won the Tour six times in a row. Is the seventh sufficient motivation for him to turn in a winning performance?
Well, I don't think seventh per se is what's motivating him. What's motivating him is this is his last race of all time, and he wants to go out on top. That's his big goal, and that's what's really driving him this year. And his team is fully behind him, and I think he's got a very, very good chance of scoring number seven.
John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been a pleasure.
John Wilkinson is author of the book 23 Days in July, Inside the Tour de France and Lance Armstrong's Record-Breaking Victory. He spoke to Only a Game's Bill Littlefield from the studios of KUVO in Denver. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And now may not be the time to read Tolstoy's War and Peace or the complete works of Shakespeare. It's summer, and many of us need something, well, frankly, a little lighter, but still filling. Here and Now's literary critic Steve Ahman is known for going off the bestseller list to find the obscure but essential gems, and he joins us now with his picks for beach reading. Welcome, Steve.
That's good to be here.
That's the trick, isn't it? A book that's breezy, but you still maintain brain cells.
Yes, that is exactly it. You try to not actively become stupider as the rest of the culture wants you to. And I have some fabulous books, and they're all, oh, thank God, they're all funny.
Good. Start with your first pick.
And I have to say, none of them is by David Sedaris. I'm glad you're sitting so you don't fall off your chair.
And don't we love David Sedaris, heard often on NPR, but all over the bestseller list, and we need other options.
Yes, we do. Wendy McClure, remember the name, committed to memory. She's written a book called I'm Not the New Me, which is a memoir, which sounds scary, but ooh, it's so very, very funny. Here is the beginning of it. How to tell a fat girl's story. You need to be brave to tell it. Very brave. You're fat, after all. Everybody can see that. It's assumed that your ability to recognize fat must be impaired for you to have become so damn fat in the first place. But it turns out that you're not blind. You can cop to the truth. You're fat. How big of you to say so? Which brings us to our next question. You weigh how much? 173 maybe, or 156, or 217, 302, 195, 260? These are only suggested numbers, of course. You will have to actually get on the scale and see for yourself. Don't worry. Once it has been established that you are fat, this weighing thing is really more of a formality than anything, because you're about to go on a journey to find yourself, to find out who you are when you're, you know, not fat.
Okay, Wendy McClure's I'm Not the New Me. I'm not sure, Steve, that's the one I want to read when I'm in a bathing suit on the beach. However.
Yeah. Well, I must say, I've been characterized more than once as a scrawny and still debatable, but pretty firmly established that I'm also a man, and I loved it. It applies to all demographics.
Okay.
It's for the inner fat person in all of us.
Wendy McClure's I'm Not the New Me. Next.
William Monahan has written what I think of as maybe the funniest novel in the past 5 years, or actually it's more like 10 years since it was published quite a while ago. It's called The Lighthouse, or actually it's just called Lighthouse, no definite article. And it will be difficult to describe in a manner that conveys just how howlingly funny it is. But it's basically a broad comedy set in the Admiral Benbow Inn, which is perhaps the most incompetently run bed and breakfast in the United States of America. And it has a cast I can't even begin to detail, except to note that it includes a drug dealer named Jesus Castro, and our hero is Tim Picasso, who's a frustrated young artist who makes off with Mr. Castro's money. And I want to read you a little bit about a character named Mr. Glowry, who is an embittered writer. Now, Robin, you know, obviously, there's
nothing.
You can't
relate to this,
yes,
no.
I can't relate to it at all. Well, here we go. And this will give you a great sense of this guy, William Monahan's comic style. I think he's howlingly funny.
Okay.
Like most evil, self-interested people, Mr. Glowry thought, it may actually be a form of innocence, that everyone else was as evil and self-interested as he was, and that no matter what he did to harm other people, he was merely protecting himself intelligently against enemies as obsessive as himself. Mr. Glowry really believed that everyone did this sort of thing constantly. He was haunted by the specter of talent, and on some days, he really believed he had it, but mainly he forgot about it and focused indefatigably on self-promotion. He gave readings regularly. His métier at the moment was the garish millennial confessio. Mr. Glowry, you see, was a geek. If screwing a live chicken in Tompkins Square Park would have gotten him two lines of notice in The Aristocrat, he would have done it twice and then have been shattered and vengeful when no one asked him to have drinks. Yes, there's nothing autobiographical in that book at all.
William Monahan's Lighthouse. And you say it's not a new book.
It is not a new book, and it is... You can find it in paperback. It is so funny that I think of it in the same category, the same world as early Martin Amis, which is essentially as funny can be.
All right. You got one more.
I do have one more. For those of you who have gotten sick of watching crime on TV, of which that's about all there is these days, I want to recommend a very offbeat and also funny crime thriller. Now, you know, that's not my normal métier.
Right.
I'm like Mr. Glowry. I'm constantly reading self-obsessed high literature that bores me to tears. But this was a crime book that I could absolutely sink my teeth into. It's called More Than They Could Chew, and it's by a writer named Rob Roberge, who has an amazing sense of plot, and he is, again, I don't read a lot of crime books that are funny, that I laugh out loud at.
Okay.
It's the story of a guy named Nick Ray, who is a down in the mouth, let's say, a recovering employee who's in Long Beach, California. And there's a lot of really beautiful writing about how sort of beat up a town Long Beach is. Rob Roberge is from Long Beach. And he gets himself embroiled in a horrible series of misadventures that involve a witness protection program list that he acquires at from an old computer. He buys some used computers and up pops these witness protection lists. I won't go into the intricacies of the plot. I'll just give you a little flavor of the cast of characters. He's working, our hero Nick Ray, with a couple of guys. Sergei, who's a Russian/Dutch gangster, and a guy who he refers to affectionately as the man with the maggot arm. Here's our introduction. At first, I called him the man with the maggot arm, and for a while, I didn't know the man with the maggot arm's real name, which it turned out later was Joe Cole. He was introduced to me as the man with the maggot arm, and that's the way it stayed until some of us shortened it to Maggot Arm Joe. Maggot Arm Joe is called that because of some special experimental treatment he's undergoing. He was a lawyer, then he was a lawyer/junkie, then he was a junkie/lawyer, then he was just a junkie. Near the end of his run with the stuff, he missed what was left of a vein and nailed muscle tissue deep and mean enough to have an infection stubborn and relentless as a buffalo winter. They tried everything, but his right arm stayed infected for 8 months. His whole stay at Terminal Island, a local prison known simply as Terminal around here. After 8 months at Terminal, he got paroled and got placed here, which is typical, as we have, as Mr. Carlyle puts it, an understanding with some of the paper pushers downtown. The here that the narrator Nick Ray is talking about is the Lincoln Hotel, of which he is the night clerk.
Okay, well, we said that these were books for those who want to venture off the bestseller list without a safety net, which is always how you travel with Steve Almond. Steve, tell me the three that you recommend, and then I know you have a couple more that just you want to tack on the titles.
Absolutely. Well, Wendy McClure's I'm Not the New Me, which is what we'll call the fat memoir. More Than They Could Chew by Rob Roberge, that's the crazy maggot arm Joe crime novel, and William Monahan's really, really funny Lighthouse novel. And also I'll recommend a book called I Should Be Extremely Happy in Your Company, which is a novel that's about Lewis and Clark and their journey across the country, and it's told in these different voices. Really terrific book, a little more serious. And also a book of short stories by a writer named Kevin Samsel, which is called Beautiful Blemish, and which is very strange and beguiling.
We'll have all of Steve Almond's choices on our website, here-now.org. Steve Almond is Here Now's literary critic, and we should mention an author in his own right. You've been on the road promoting your Evil B.B. Chow and Other Stories, your collection of short stories. You send out missives. I have one here.
Yes.
Let's see. Number of baths taken on the road, 9. Number of CD mixes burned while in the car, 11. Number of Support the Troops magnetic ribbons spotted on the trip, 947.
Yes.
But you're also the author of Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. And as I always ask you when you return home, got any good new candy?
Well, I in fact do have good new candy. I spent a considerable time at the Candy Expo pleading the people from Master Foods International, which used to be known as Mars M&M, to come out with a dark chocolate Snickers. Mm-hmm. I am talking Hunger Strike, which was not very effective at the Candy Expo, right in their booth. And I secured, if not a promise, they did not actually call security on me. So I'm predicting that there will be a dark chocolate Snickers before the millennium is out.
Okay, Here and Now's literary critic and candy connoisseur, Steve Almond. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.